Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to That's a Take. I'm your host, Bruce James Bales, and we're back with another stellar episode. Take 6 is my conversation with Caitlin Busby about the advantages of graduate film school. Caitlin recently wrapped up her studies at NYU, and she was kind enough to sit down with me to walk me through what it was like going through that program. Throughout the whole episode, she's incredibly transparent and eloquent about her experiences, and the whole conversation felt rather therapeutic in a way. I made my first real short film with Caitlin, and it's been great to see her flourish and grow as a filmmaker, so this talk was long overdue and full of great advice. I've always been curious about film school and graduate film school, and Caitlin did a really great job of highlighting the advantages despite her distinctly altered experience due to COVID. I was actually able to work on a few of her NYU projects, so we talk about those, what it was like working in the city, what it was like having access to the top-of-line gear, and how the program helped Caitlin to become a better filmmaker across the board. With that, let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Caitlin Busby about the advantages of graduate film school. Yeah, we're here today to talk about your experience at film school, graduate film school specifically. I think one reason why I wanted to talk to you is because I've always been really curious about film school, and I think there's so many good things about it, and some of those things maybe get overshadowed on the in the greater culture of the filmmaking internet sometimes.
the people that like to revolt against film school.
Yeah, and that's all well and fine. They're entitled to their opinions, but I wanted to get it more from, you know, someone who's actually experienced it and talk about those good things and talk about the things that you really took away that made you a better filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
In case someone is on the fence about an experience like this, whether it's undergraduate or graduate film school. So to start off, kind of just give us an overview of what program you chose. Where did you study and about how long was the program?
Yeah. So after looking around for a while, I chose NYU Graduate Film School. They chose me also, thankfully.
Yeah. And that's something people should know. It's not just you have to get in.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be accepted.
Massively. Yeah. Which was a process in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I looked at a few schools out in LA. I looked at Columbia and Chicago. I went to an admitted student's day there. You know, bless that program, not for me. It was a kind of messy day, and it just felt like the organization wasn't there, and like the passion didn't fully feel there for me. Also just the instructors that I met. It just didn't feel like the right fit for me.
Yeah.
And then I went to New York after I got invited for the interview, so I wasn't in yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the day I was like, I want to go here.
Yeah.
This is the place I want to be.
That's great.
Yeah.
What was it that stuck out to you specifically? Do you have a moment or a couple things that just kind of made you feel like that was the home for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think in and of itself, the like place of NYU, it's, you know, it's a campus that's embedded in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So you go there and it's like, oh, I'm in New York. You know, this is the campus. New York City is the campus. And that is such a part of the experience of going to Tisch. And then it was the interview, which is about a 30 to 45 minute process.
Mm-hmm.
During COVID times, it went remote again. I think they're back to in-person again.
Good.
But it was something where, you know, if there's any way you can be there in person. I had classmates down the road who, you know, flew halfway across the world just for the interview.
Wow.
So, it's a process where you have three of the professors sit down and ask you about why NYU, what makes you want to become a filmmaker. And it was exceptionally personal. It was a very vulnerable interview. And I was like, okay, so this is a program unlike what I felt like from the other ones where they're going to meet me where I'm at, as opposed to me having to like retrofit myself into where the program is at.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a great reason to go to NYU. I mean, that's what you want out of education. Having an education background myself, like the education that's tailored to the student is the best education you can get. So I'm really happy to hear that. And also, there's a great point about the city being sort of your backdrop for school. You're talking about a city that's so vivid. It's such a crazy color palette. It's a culturally diverse city, unlike any other on, you know, that side of the United States, really. It's a mecca. It's one of the first cities in the United States that really grew and flourished. And how did you find yourself being inspired by the city once you decided to go there?
Yeah. You know, I'm Iowa born and bred. Went to University of Iowa undergrad. Spent about 7 years in Iowa City after working in marketing at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd never lived in a big city. And so I think there's this initial sort of like shock that happens, but it wasn't a bad shock. It was like an exciting shock. I was like feeling invigorated and inspired in a way that I don't think I had felt before. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, like I said, NYU campus is in the heart. Like, we're a couple blocks away from Washington Square Park. So every day walking through Washington Square Park, getting off the A train, walking to the Tisch building, every day walking back, and like, you're just a part of that community. And it's pretty rare to live in Lower Manhattan around NYU. Some students do, but most people live in Brooklyn. That's where we found a spot. And so, I mean, you're a part of the fabric of the city the second you move there. And thank God, like, you have the community of your cohort and NYU as a whole, you know, to kind of ground you in that. Like, I think that was a big comfort moving to such a big city, is like, okay, I have my built-in people. But yeah, I mean, you're all of a sudden thrown into the chaos and the beauty of New York. And I found it exceptionally inspiring. And it's the perfect place to people watch, right? Like, the stories you can come up with just from sitting on the train for 15 minutes. It's unbelievable. Just observing and, being a sponge to the city.
I'm glad you said chaos and beauty. I think that's really a great way to describe New York City. And also, I think of a quote, I think it might have been Aaron Sorkin, who was asked kind of like why he didn't live in LA. And I wish I had someone to fact check this for sure. But he responded with something like, well, everyone in LA is doing the same thing. I like New York because I can walk down the street and like meet 10 different kinds of people.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah. And I've always thought that there's nothing wrong with LA. I love LA, but New York is so interesting. Like you said, there's stories kind of in every corner. And if, it's just a great place to be inspired. And also the pulse of the city, I'm sure, had an effect on that, you know, that experience as well. Getting down to like sort of the nitty gritty of the program, how much work was in the classroom? Is it a program where at the beginning you're in the classroom? Are you in the classroom all of the time? Can you kind of talk about like how much time was spent in the classroom versus on set or in different environments?
Totally. I would say towards the beginning of the program, you are spending more time in the like quote unquote classroom, but like that classroom is so active. Like, you're moving around, right? You're taking classes in all areas of production. They're really training you to be like a Swiss Army knife kind of holistic approach to film school, where you're learning production design, you're learning sound, you're learning cinematography. We rotate roles during the first curriculum film, where you're one film you have to gaff, one film you have to AC, you have to DP. So in that sense, it's super active. And even before going into production on the curriculum films, you're in the classroom and you're, you know, up on your feet. You're doing things. there are classes that are more history-driven or aesthetic-driven, where it's more lecture style, but it's an exceptionally active program. And you're spending all your weekends making directing class exercises, and you're thrown in. Like, it's not a like, let's ease into, you know, film school. It's like you hit the ground running. And I think they've designed a curriculum over the course of several decades now that it has a really good arc to it. Now, I will say that arc was very much interrupted for my cohort because our first year COVID hit in the spring. And so that definitely altered the shape of our curriculum and what is typical. And in some ways, I think it made the film school experience even more unique and like added to the strengths of it. In other ways, it was certainly, you know, a detriment. There was a big period of time where we were virtual, and it's hard to do something that is so active virtually. So they had to kind of shift things around and get a little bit more writing focused during that period of time. But yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to walk you through the like curriculum as a full, or at least just like the bullet points, right?
Yeah, that'd be great. Because I think that's one thing that people aren't going to know unless they go to film school, right? Is like, what's the structure of the educational experience?
So I mentioned taking classes in all these like areas of the production, pre-production, post-production, you know, arena of filmmaking. In your first year, the first project that you're gearing up towards, that you're like working in all your classes towards, is what they call the MOS. And it's a 4-minute, no dialogue, shot on black and white film, 16 millimeter film. And so they, how it's designed is like they have all these restrictions kind of at first with the first curriculum film, and with each curriculum film, they're kind of slowly removing some restrictions, right?
Very cool.
So that first one is all about visual storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, why not start with a silent film? If you can't tell the story of the silent film, they're going to have trouble with the words.
Exactly.
And sound. That's awesome.
Exactly.
That's a cool challenge.
And I know we've talked about like shooting on film and, you know, how you have to, like, it's forcing you to be intentional because like at the end of the, you only have so much, you know, film stock that you're working with.
Exactly. Yeah.
You can't like roll too soon, play with improv too much. Like you really have to be super intentional with everything you're doing. So that was a great one to start the program out on.
That's fascinating. So talk about kind of how those restrictions are lifted over time. Like what's after the MOS project?
So after MOS, which is very, I almost wanted to say manufactured, but it's not manufactured. It's very organic how they like help us kind of find our voice and the script that we want to tell and, you know, the specificity of it. Mm-hmm. But then they switch to what they call the OCS, which is an observational character study documentary. And that's a short documentary that we shoot over that first break. So we've just gotten done with a semester of classes. We've just gotten done shooting this MOS film, cutting it, finishing it, going to a big review where all the professors watch it and like tear you apart. But it's a good thing. It's a helpful thing.
We have to talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, there are a lot of tear apart sessions. It's out of love though.
Yeah.
And then you move into this documentary project, which is supposed to be kind of the antithesis of that. It's very freeing. It's all about just observing, listening, you know, being open to the moment. And yeah. So that was the first project I did over break after that first semester.
I got to be honest, hearing this, it's just, you know, reinvigorating me with the idea of why I wanted to talk to you. Because, like, I think this is a really well-crafted program we're talking about so far. I mean, we're two films into your experience in grad school. And already, like, I'm like, oh, wow, what an amazing exercise to learn how to be a better storyteller. So after your OCS, what comes after the observational character study?
Yeah, well done. So MOS, OCS, and then at that point in the program, it's supposed to be spring narrative. Spring narrative is a 7-minute tops long script that you're creating, up to 3 characters, up to 3 locations. Now, we were 3 weeks away from going into production on our spring narrative projects, and COVID hit.
Yeah.
And so massive, you know, pivots all around. I think it was March 13th, everything went remote. Some people, including myself, you know, decided to hunker down in New York and kind of ride out the situation. A couple weeks into that, realized that, you know, it was going to be a longer situation. So at that point, I decided to come back to Iowa for a period of time. And we were remote at that point. It didn't make sense to stay in a little Brooklyn apartment when we could be near family and have space and nature and all that. So, So Spring Narrative was definitely put on hold, and they ended up, after a lot of kind of stumbles and just being human together and kind of figuring out the way forward, adding essentially another curriculum project, which was an isolation film. And so we all made films by ourselves about our period of time during COVID and remote learning.
Wow. I applaud them at their ability to pivot, honestly. And what a bonding experience that must have been for you, not only with your cohort, but with the professors and the people running the program. I imagine that in some ways this brought you guys closer together, even though you're farther apart. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and they made like a concerted effort to, we have something every month called a chair workshop where the chair of the department brings in, you know, usually a very exciting guest. We watch a film, we talk about it with them. And they made an effort to really bring in, you know, exciting guests during that period of time because the whole world was remote. Like we got access to some really interesting people. We had a lot more class meetings, cohort meetings where we were just hanging out together. Writing groups emerged out of that period of time. So we made it as worthwhile as we could, for sure.
That had to be tough. But I applaud your guys' willingness and ability to be flexible throughout what was ultimately one of the most wild rides of our existence so far, I think. Definitely an interesting experience. Going back to sort of the structure after our added isolation film, what's next in sort of the trajectory?
Yeah, so then I was like, okay, let's get back to the spring narrative that you guys were about to go out on production for.
Good.
And that I actually shot here in Iowa and you crewed up on.
Yeah.
I was very lucky to have the whole like Iowa crew of awesome former collaborators suddenly mm-hmm. enter this world of NYU, which I had been in for, you know, almost a full year at that point. Mm-hmm. And so it kept getting delayed. The SAG guidelines, you know, were exceptionally strict, and they should have been at that period of time.
Yeah.
NYU's were even stricter.
Yeah.
So we were operating under SAG guidelines, and then we were operating under NYU guidelines on mm-hmm. top of that.
Yeah.
Production kept getting pushed. It got to a point where it was unclear, like, when we would be able to go out and actually make films again. Mm-hmm. We were given a window of time where we were given the green light. I decided to shoot early because I had written a script that could very easily be shot in New York, but also could definitely be, you know, transplanted to Iowa. So mm-hmm. I pushed to shoot early and make the film while I was still back before heading back out to New York. Mm-hmm. So that happened end of December into January of, this would have been 2019 going into 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. And we shot that film. NYU at that point was the first film school to go back into production. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like scary and exciting all at once.
Yeah.
I had cast very intentionally a married couple because I was able to prove that they were already like potted.
Yeah.
And they could be closer than, yes. you know, 6 feet.
Yeah.
Right after I got done shooting my film and went back to New York, the restrictions got even tighter. They pushed production a little further down the road. And now even if actors were quote unquote potted together, a married couple, or had been, you know, quarantining together for 2 to 3 weeks, mm-hmm. They still had to be 6 to 10 feet apart at all times. Mm. So it changed scripts for a lot of my classmates and friends.
Yeah,
and yeah, I mean, it was like a period of time that was all about flexibility.
Yeah. It's interesting because I wouldn't have imagined that your film school experience was this based on restrictions. But I think about some of the more influential sort of filmmaking exercises I've done, and The 48 comes to mind.
Totally.
With the restrictions and how restrictions can often force you to be more creative. So how did you continue that creativity forward after that film? And what was next?
Yeah. So after the spring narrative, which we finally got around to, which admittedly felt, because we'd gotten like a quote-unquote bonus film in our curriculum, mm-hmm. it felt a little bit more akin to what they call the second year film. Mm-hmm. We were in our second years. We were making what was supposed to be a spring of first year project. Mm-hmm. So after that, I know it gets confusing. There are a lot of films in this program. We went to the true second year film.
Got it.
But we didn't go into production on that until our third year.
Okay. I mean, everything was messed up by COVID.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that is a film that the restrictions, again, are lifted a little further even. So there are no more limitations on number of characters. There are no more limitations on number of locations. Mm-hmm. The only limitation that exists, it has to be 10 minutes or less.
Okay.
And so I went into production on that film in October of 2021.
Great. And then after that, what are the last couple of projects that wrapped up your sort of making in grad school?
Yeah. It becomes a little bit of like a choose your own adventure at that point.
Cool.
We're set with pretty specific classes that we take in first and second year. Mm-hmm. And then we start to get to like elective period of time. Okay. Now, most of the, just to like bird's eye view it and back up a little bit, most of the people that go to NYU are going in with the like hope and intention of becoming writer directors.
Okay.
We're all trained as such. Mm-hmm. However, because we break out and we learn all the different roles of a crew, like people start to find interests and loves that they might not have had before grad school. So mm-hmm. you can graduate with a writing directing focus, but you can also graduate with a cinematography focus.
Great.
You can graduate with an editing focus and a producing focus.
Very cool. So did you find yourself venturing into any of those other areas other than writer director?
Yeah, I've served as a DP on a lot of projects mm-hmm. since I was like quite young, yeah. like 16 years mm-hmm. old when I first started picking up a camera with buddies. And so that's always been a part of my bones and a part of my like, I don't know, how I like to explore creatively and how I like to collaborate creatively. So that did not go away during grad school. That definitely continued to like evolve and morph. And that was exciting. And it's still something I love to do. I did decide to still graduate with a writing directing focus.
Yeah.
A big intention of mine deciding to take the leap and go to NYU was like to be kind of vulnerable and personal here. Like I felt like prior to grad school, I was involved in all of these, you know, very exciting projects. Mm-hmm. But they all felt like I was kind of supporting other people in their vision.
Yeah.
And I never felt like I had intentionally carved the time and space for me to, like, explore what I wanted to say and explore the films that I wanted to make. And so that was a big motivator for going to Tisch. And so it felt really like, it felt like the move to still stick with the writing, directing path in terms of the focus in which I graduated. That said, like, I did have all the qualifications to graduate as a DP mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm, you know, without being sort of, I don't know, I'm proud of you for staying true to yourself in that respect. I think that's important. And it's hard in this film industry to, like, be like, no, I'm going to do this because this is what makes me feel most fulfilled. And I can tell by talking to you just outside of the podcast that this experience was fulfilling for you and that it helped you grow. And that's really all that matters. And that's why we're dissecting this here, is to figure out, like, it's not about film school, this conversation, as much as it's about figuring out what works for you and figuring
exactly.
out, like, what you care about. And that's what a lot of the journey of being a filmmaker is taking that time and saying, what really matters to me? Because ultimately, like, we're storytellers. Yes, there's a business side, but we're all here because we like telling stories.
Yeah. And, like, you get to the heart of it. Whenever anybody approaches me and is like, hey, you know, I'm thinking about film school, I'm like, okay, I will be as much of an open book as I possibly can for you. Like, let's talk through the reasons why. Like, why is it that you are wanting to seek out this life move? Mm-hmm. You know, what's behind that? And then we can figure out if it feels like the right move. And every program is different, too. Like, I can speak truth to my experience, at least in at Tisch and at NYU, but every program is different.
Yeah. I remember when I had kind of thoughts about it, I talked to you, and one thing I was impressed with your response was you weren't like, do it or don't do it. You're like, yeah, we should talk. Instead of, like, telling me yes or no, because it's like, clearly there's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a, you know, a black and white answer where it's like yes or no. It's like, why?
Right.
You know? And I think that's a guiding North Star for filmmaking as a whole, is the question why.
But, yeah.
Kind of shifting gears a little bit, you kind of touched upon this, but you said NYU did a really great job of bringing people in to talk to you and to share work with you. Can you talk about some of your more memorable visitors and, like, more importantly, what were some really great lessons or a memorable lesson you took away from one of those visitors?
There are a lot. I mean, I was like,
this is part of the cool thing. Like, feel free. Like, no one's going to roast you for name dropping.
That's sweet. When you asked me to do this, I was like, okay, like, I'm going to try to be as helpful and honest as possible with this. And I glanced back through, you know, what is now 5+ years of notes. And I was just like, I don't even remember some of it. Because it's just grad school is like drinking through a fire hose. And you're trying to stay on your feet mm-hmm. and absorb as much as possible. Because it's really very exciting. Mm-hmm. And so aside from just like some full-time faculty, some adjuncts that are amazing kind of top of game filmmakers. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the chair workshop series. So we have really exciting guests come in. On the drive over to your place, I was like, what were some of the chair workshops that stood out? And I ran into one that I shouldn't have recorded, but I recorded on my phone and I'm just keeping it for me if anybody ever listens and tries to berate me for this, with Taika Waititi. Mm-hmm. And we met with him during like the worst part of COVID.
Yeah.
And he was just a beam of light.
Good.
And you can tell, I mean, you can tell watching his films, but like the playfulness that he approaches his films with, he approaches everyday life with. And I think, you know, one thing that we talk about, I've talked about with several professors now, but also the guests tend to talk about this too, is like every project is going to have a different way to prep for it, depending on the nature of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Taika really spoke to that in terms of how they approach what we do in the shadows and mm-hmm. how he approached Jojo Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And just some really exciting and fun like gems from that. Around that time, we also got to speak with Roger and James Deakins, which was very exciting. I'm just going to start listing the people that like I've loved. Like,
I mean, to be honest, this is me like fanboying out because I'm all about this. Like, I want to know who you got. Just, it doesn't matter. Like, no one's going to roast you. Like, we want to know the cool people you got to hear talk, honestly.
Oh, man. So my third year, I was a GA graduate associate for I was a cinematography graduate associate, and one of the professors I got to work with, who's just a powerhouse, is Fred Elms, and he shot a lot of David Lynch's work,
yeah,
among many other projects. Mm-hmm. So he brought in a lot of cool guests too, like Barry Jenkins, Rob, who, you know, Moonlight, etc. Yeah. Robert Uman, Bob, who's Wes Anderson's DP.
Dolly Master.
Yeah, Dolly Master, Whip Pan Master. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do all that. He does all of that just
Symmetry.
Live.
Yeah. They're wild. That Dolly grip. If anybody knows the Dolly grip on the Wes Anderson movies, I want to have him on.
I'm pretty sure he talked about him when he met with us, because that's a, you know, huge part of his operation and how he creates his visual world.
Yeah. Barry's also extremely well-spoken about being a filmmaker. I love listening to that guy anytime there's a podcast or a video. He's so intelligent, and so he's got such a great energy to him.
Yeah, yeah. A standout was Celine Sciamma. Mm-hmm. And this was, I mean, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is one of my favorite films.
So
it's so beautifully crafted, and there's just so much intention behind every single decision.
Yes.
In that film, and she had just come out with a smaller film that I don't think many people saw, unfortunately, called Petite Mama.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this?
I've heard of it. I did not see it. But I need to, because it's
so pretty.
I wasn't aware that it was the same director.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just see things in passing and you don't really register. But now I must watch that film, because Portrait of a Lady on Fire is like breathtaking, blew me away, absolutely like knocked me back with just, it's like you said, it was so well crafted and so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the whole time she was on Zoom with us, because she was in Europe, the whole time she was smoking a cigarette and just looking like a complete badass. And just talking about the things that she chases as a filmmaker and like a storyteller. You know, it's just like what intrigues her, confuses her, excites her, what, makes her blood boil, and like gravitating towards those curiosities in her work and then just mining them. And so it's like she might not even know what the next project is, and it might be entirely different than the last project, which is definitely the case in a lot of ways with Portrait of a Lady and Petite Mama and then her previous work. But just following that impulse and staying true to what's intriguing you, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's why I wanted to know about these things, because these are really like, it's not about like name dropping. It's more about the inspiration you get from people that are doing it, right? And the people that are doing it at a high level, because it's great. You can go on the internet and you can find a lot of resources, right? But like being in the same room once you got past COVID and past the remoteness of it all, and being able to like physically interact with these people, it does a couple things, right? It gives you access to their minds and their perspectives, but also it reminds you that they're people. It reminds you that they're just human beings trying to make films just like you are.
Yeah.
And what it does, I think, is it makes you realize that you can be there one day too.
Yeah. You said it. I mean, very, very inspiring. Walking out of those workshops and those sessions with these guests, like I've never felt as high as I do walking out of those sessions.
Yeah,
like your whole being is vibrating when you leave those. And you just feel like you could conquer the world, you know?
Yeah. And you're talking about the best of the best.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the upper echelon of filmmakers.
Yeah.
I mean, those names are people that have made really great films. We're talking about Oscar-winning directors, best picture directors, you know? So I'm blown away by that, because I think as much as people want to look at it and sort of balk and say, oh, it's just about the name, really, if it was just about the name, these people wouldn't still be in the film industry. Like, they're making good projects, and that is a part of the educational experience. More so, like, you mentioned instructors. Who are some that you really gelled with?
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk about, like, how you gelled with them and how those relationships helped to, you know, you to grow as a filmmaker?
Mm. A lot. A lot of professors that have also become friends now. I guess I'm just going to start listing the ones that like have left a pretty big mark on me, because I think I've had, you know, 20, 30 professors over the course, because they bring in adjuncts who are also, you know, coming in for a semester here and there. But as far as core faculty that have really, made an impact on my work, Jen Ruff comes to mind. She's the editing teacher at Tisch. We have a few. She's one of them. And I just love how she approaches her work. She's a beautiful hippie. And she just approaches it with such tenderness and truth and honesty. And she's a collaborator that I've now, I've shot a music video for her. We just booked the tickets two nights ago. I'm going to go shoot a film on 8mm in Costa Rica with her at the end of May.
Amazing.
Which I'm so stoked about. Now I'm like, wow, I got to pull up my old, you know, celluloid notes and figure out how to shoot 8mm because I have not done that one yet. But she's somebody who comes to mind that is just really, she inspires us to stay true to our internal, you know, truth barometers with the work that we make. Andrew McLean, he was my thesis faculty advisor. He's a writer-director who, there are two directing faculty members that come to mind for this question. One is Andrew. The other one is Alexander Rockwell, who both were in my interview that I told you about.
Your invitation interview where you went and the three people are grilling you about your passions.
Yeah, which side note, the reason why I wanted to go to the program, you know, not solely, but they asked in my interview, like, when in your life have you felt the most shame? And I was like, whoa, like, that's a big question to ask somebody you've just met.
Yeah.
But they're just trying to, like, see if you can be open
and vulnerable,
mm-hmm. and truthful. And also then, you know, say that story, tell that story however it feels right to you. And then they kind of walk you through an exercise of, like, how would you say that in a visual way without words? So that's all a side note, but
wow,
yeah,
and that's your interview
that's
to get
interview.
In. Okay, wow.
Yeah, so Alexander Rockwell and Andrew McLean are two directing faculty members who have very different approaches. Alex is very much like guttural, and I know you and I were having a recent conversation about like acting theorists and Meisner versus Grotowski.
Yeah.
So like Alex is very much in the Grotowski mindset of like, let's get into the work through our bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
And Andrew's like, okay, no, like let's approach this a little bit more like intellectually and like, why do we do the things we do? Mm-hmm. So those are two teachers that come to mind.
Well, that's cool that you're able, I think that's the beauty of like the educational system when it works, right? Is you get these two schools of thought juxtaposed against each other. And that is like so illuminating. Because you can be like, oh, I like what Andrew's saying here. And, oh, I like this coming from here. And you can create your own thought. Because, like, you know, why I was drawn to education is because some of the most memorable, life-changing experiences I've ever had were in a classroom or in an educational setting. Because the guidance that you receive, it's really just reinforcement. You're doing all of it yourself. Those people are just reinforcing your learning. So it's great to hear that you had people on both sides of the spectrum to learn from, and it's not just like one school of thought.
Right.
And it seems like it's a really diverse program across the board as far as like the way people think and the way they create films. It's not just, this is the way you do it. It's like, here's how some people do it.
Yeah.
Figure it out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it. They are so transparent about like, hey, this is what works for me. Like, you got to find what works for you and add the things that do work for you to your toolkit and then pull them out when you need to, you know?
Yeah, we're all just making our toolkit and deciding what tools we want in the kit.
Yep.
That's great. Yeah. Speaking of toolkit, that's a great segue. I love when good segues happen naturally in the podcast. It makes me so happy. It makes my job so easy.
You've designed this. You're the architect.
I guess I did. I don't know. But you talked to me about having access to gear, like top of the line gear. And I know some people are just like complete gearheads. We won't go down that path. But like,
yeah.
How important was it for you to be able to go to a rental house and to tinker and prep and test? Like, that's something I don't take for granted without a rental house close by. You know, it's, you learn so much by being like, hey, I'm going to try that lens set. Let's see what that looks like. Can you talk about that experience and like how valuable that was for you?
Yeah. I mean, that's the bread and butter of, you know, when you come out of film school and you start to work on a project and you're in those early stages, like you're going to, if you're in New York, if you're really anywhere, like you're going to be working with rental houses as like that first step to crafting a visual world for whatever project you're working on. So the fact that that is integrated into the program is like super helpful, right?
Yeah.
I can't say, Before going to NYU, I don't think I'd ever really been in a real rental house.
Yeah.
And they have a really great relationship with Aerie. They have a really great relationship with Able, which is a rental house. Well, both of those are rental houses that exist in several cities.
Yep.
Able is the one that processes most of our equipment for once we get to second year film, once we get to thesis film, mm-hmm. which I realize we need to jump back to that curriculum arc, which we will at some point.
Yeah.
And so you also have the NYU Production Center, which does provide a lot of our equipment for whenever we go out on set. But it's kind of a hodgepodge of, okay, we're getting some stuff from this rental house and we're getting some stuff from NYU. Mm-hmm. And then once you get into advanced cinematography classes, you have full classes at like Panavision, at Arri, and you're building cameras, you're mm-hmm. playing with cameras, you're generously from them, like taking out cameras for a few weeks to play with in the classroom, which is how we were able to shoot on 35 millimeter for the cinematography practicum class. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just grateful, A, to have that access, and B, that rental houses are like supportive of students.
Yeah.
You know, and also want to extend the relationship past studenthood into like, I'm out of the program now. Like, hey, I'm trying to make this short film. Like, it's not a huge budget. Can you help me out? And mm-hmm. usually they're pretty supportive.
Yeah, it never hurts to ask. That's one thing I've learned. And I think just to put this in a perspective of a filmmaker from a smaller market, like where I'm at, I've never seen a Panavision camera in person like that. You know what I mean? Like, and if you look at how many films are shot on Panavision, like, that's something I probably should, you know, figure out someday is like mm-hmm. go to, you know, a Panavision rental house and tinker, because eventually I want to use a Panavision yeah. camera. So just like, it's not about like the illustrious Panavision name. It's about being a tool, and you learn, you go to those rental houses and you learn about these cameras as a tool. Yes, they're very expensive. Yes, some of them can be flashy, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it's just a thing we use to make the movie,
yeah.
which I think is important to denote. But
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So there, it's, you know, this podcast is mirroring film school. We're like two paths right now. Which one will we choose? We're going to go back and talk more about the structure and follow up with kind of how your grad program wrapped up with the last couple of films that you made. So you should want to pick it up there. And then I want to talk about 35 millimeter
yeah.
as well.
Definitely. Yeah. One note I want to say, what you just said in regards to like, hey, this is just a camera and like a tool to make the film. Mm-hmm. We had a really wonderful cinematography professor, Felipe Vara del Rey, who's now out in LA. He left New York. But he, you know, really hammered into us through his class that every camera is kind of the same. Like, at the end of the day, like, yes, they have different bells and whistles and different yeah. tools to approach the work with, but it's about what you put in front of the camera, not to sound cheesy, but it is.
100%.
So, yeah, he would always, when we were, especially in pre-production for projects, would ask us, like, you know, if your protagonist were to shoot this film, like, how would it look?
And ooh, so that's great.
Yeah, approaching the visual world of the film, well, the visual world of the film through the eyes of the protagonist is like one of those tools that I was like, oh, I love that.
That's
and it might
wonderful.
Not be applicable to every single project, but man, it gets you thinking about your film in a whole nother way.
That's really great. Yeah, that's really great. And I think it's interesting for me, having recorded like six of these podcasts so far, there's like all these recurring themes, because I'm interviewing like people that started more in the indie level. And one of them is like, don't get caught up in technology and just make your movie. So getting back to making movies, where did you go from second year film?
Yeah.
After second year film, where did the trajectory take you?
Yeah. So I mentioned it at that point is kind of like a choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
So there's this class that's offered that's called Collab. That's really an exciting opportunity. Mm-hmm. A lot of students at that point are a little burnt out, and so they don't take the opportunity for Collab. Mm-hmm. But what it is it's a directing class. So you have, I think it's like 7 to 10 writer directors who apply for the class and then get selected. You have the same amount of DPs who are in a cinematography practicum class. Mm-hmm. You have the graduate actors. So then we start to branch out into different departments from grad film, mm-hmm. which is the exciting part. And then you have the production designers. And
cool.
so you start to really get to work like interdepartmentally. And that's an exciting opportunity. I decided to approach that class as a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. I was one of those that felt a little burnt out with writing and directing at that point and wanted to just kind of collaborate and explore more of the cinematography world. Mm-hmm. So I shot one of the collab films with somebody who's become a dear friend now. And that film surprisingly ended up premiering at Tribeca, even though it was shot over the course of a weekend. So I think what's exciting about that is, like, you start to get to meet collaborators who are like, you know, all boats rise, right?
Yeah.
So they're just upping your game. And that's mm-hmm. something that one of our professors at NYU, Spike Lee, says really regularly is, like, let the people around you up your game.
Yeah. Yeah. On the first episode of the podcast, Marissa used a great phrase that is applicable here, which is network laterally mm-hmm. and find people that are like at the close to the same level as you, but like can. I think it's easier to like grow and rise with people that are like right about the same level with you, but even like a step above you, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? 2-3 steps above you, sometimes it's like too much of a stretch, but that person you're like, oh, I really like what they did here. And then you rise to that level
yeah.
and you sort of join them there, which is sort of akin to the quote you had about all, you know, high tides raise all boats. But
yeah,
yeah, so from there you're getting to collaborate, you're getting to be, you know, a cinematographer, take a break from writing and directing. How did that sort of invigorate you for what was next after collab?
So after collab, you also have the opportunity to take a commercial directing class, which has always been a huge interest of mine, especially coming from a marketing background before going into grad school.
Yeah.
I was really interested in getting back into that world just mm-hmm. on a little bit, you know, larger scale.
Yeah.
And so we take a class with kind of rotating professors take that on, but always like working commercial directors. And throughout the course of the semester, you make a commercial. And it's leading up to that, you are playing with, similar to our directing classes, a lot of weekends of what we call directing exercises. So
yeah.
like little assignments that we have to go out and shoot and then bring back to the classroom and then get workshopped. But yeah, at the end of that semester, we shoot a commercial, which we can shoot on 35 if we want to, or mm-hmm. we can shoot on digital.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point we were still shooting on red, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but mm-hmm. it gets the job done.
Yeah.
An older model. So, yeah, so I made a Apple AirPod spec commercial in
nice.
That class. And then you move on to thesis.
Nice.
And so that's what wraps up your whole experience at NYU.
A quick tangent. I'm really impressed that they did a commercial directing class.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of shocked by that, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, like, filmmaking, at least educationally, seems so narrative focused. And documentary, too.
Yeah.
But you don't hear much about, like, educational experiences to do with commercial. And, like, that, I think it should be more prevalent. So I'm really happy to hear that. What, just as a tangent, what was something that you took away from that class that stuck with you? If there's something that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think I'm going to sound like starting to sound like a little bit of a broken record, but like even in the glossy commercial work, you know, finding the human driven stories within that, like you only have such a short amount of time to really hook an audience and kind of pull their heart in.
Yeah.
And that can be, you know, it doesn't have to be through drama. It can be through comedy. It can be whatever kind of genre mode you want in this commercial. But mm-hmm. Yeah, just finding a way to really pull them in quickly. Like it's a very, very short form way of storytelling. So mm-hmm. We focused a lot on that and crafting that.
Yeah, I think it's easy from my perspective of working in the commercial world. It's easy to get far away from what we're trying to do, which is ultimately like we're trying to connect with an audience. And sometimes with commercial work, it's like, it's almost like the options are too prevalent because you can kind of do whatever you want. You can kind of work with any genre you want, which I think is great.
Right.
But that's also like daunting a little bit because you can do so much. But
yeah.
I think we're in a golden age of commercial work. We have been for like the last decade. We're just seeing some really great stuff and
mm-hmm.
stuff that, you know, pulls at your heartstrings, stuff that makes you laugh, stuff that technically you're just like,
what?
How yeah. did they do that?
Yeah.
You know, I think of that Apple commercial with FK Twigs.
Uh-huh, yeah, that
was
one comes
done,
to mind first.
Done by Hoyt Van Hoytema. And
who is one person we got to talk with?
Oh,
one
really?
Of our, yeah, cinematography.
In person or on?
On Zoom.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
just, oddly, I'm just curious to see him in
yeah.
person because operating that IMAX camera, I assume you got to be a big, strong guy
Seriously.
To do, or big, strong person, excuse
yeah.
me, to do. Cause like,
yeah.
man, that thing is huge.
Massive.
Yeah.
yeah.
That was a tangent. But so we're at thesis time.
Yeah.
And this is correct me if I'm wrong, this is the culminating project mm-hmm. of your graduate school experience. Can you talk about mm-hmm. what you decided to do for your thesis and, you know, how production went?
Yeah. So there's a cat. Sorry.
This happens every time.
I love this.
And yeah. Okay. So just for the viewers, I have a cat with my girlfriend, Sydney, and his name is Bodhi. And usually for the first 40 minutes, Bodhi does not care to interrupt the podcast. But around 40, 45 minute mark, he usually makes an appearance. And it always goes like this.
I love this.
Yeah,
he's
I know.
Your
everybody loves it. Sometimes he eats food in the background and we have to do some sound editing. But, you know, we love him.
He's beautiful.
Yeah. He did, I think it's in the episode that's coming out soon, he makes an appearance because he just came in and goes, and I'm keeping this. It in. I'm keeping it in.
You have to.
Yeah.
You have to.
He's going to be a fixture in these podcasts.
Yeah.
So.
That's good.
Bodhi break is what I called
Bodhi
it.
Bodhi break.
Bodhi break.
But you can
yeah.
have theme music for that specifically.
Oh, that's a good idea. When I was doing my podcast with Hannah Rosalie Wright, we had a Bodhi break.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It was great.
All right.
But yeah, getting back to the question, I'll go for it again. So the culminating experience in your graduate film school experience was this thesis film. Can you kind of run us through what you decided to do for a thesis film and kind of how production went?
Yeah, absolutely. You have, similar to the kind of choose your own adventure feeling that has been the last like year and a half of the program up mm-hmm. till that point, you have a lot of options for how you graduate, how you officially graduate. Not only the tracks that I talked about, the mm-hmm. focus tracks, but what you submit. So you can submit a full feature screenplay, which some people do if they're at that point where they're like, you know, I'm not really feeling like another short film right now. Like, I want to put all my energy in on this. They do that. You can submit a few episodes of episodic series content writing. Mm-hmm. So one of the classes we take is a TV writing class, which is great. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of times what people end up doing.
Yeah.
You can, I believe, create a doc too, which most people don't, but maybe yeah. some people have. Mm-hmm. What people tend to do the most at that point is shoot another short film.
Yeah.
And so that's what I decided to do, is mm-hmm. shoot kind of one last, maybe not last, short film to culminate everything.
And what restrictions are on the thesis?
None.
Finally.
Finally.
We have free reign, baby.
There.
That's great. So how did that feel for you to just be able to do whatever you want with your thesis?
I'm going to be real. I like the restrictions.
See, they make us more creative.
They do. You know, I still had a great time working on my thesis. We shot it at the end of this last summer. I'm still in post for it. Mm-hmm. It was a script that's been kind of living in my body for almost 10 years now. I wrote the first draft of it well before I even applied to grad school. But I like the restrictions,
yeah.
I gotta say. And what's great about that realization is that, you know, they can be self-implemented.
Yeah.
You can make a film with the intention of, I'm going to stick to these restrictions, and I bet it's going to make it stronger in the long run.
I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people think about films like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, with directors I work with, we try to make rules, you know?
Yeah.
Like rules like, hey, how are we going to cover this? And try not to break them unless it's one of those moments where you
exactly
it's a rule breaking moment.
Yeah.
But like that restriction builds structure.
Yep.
And often sometimes when you have the world at your fingertips,
yeah,
you're just like, give me some structure.
Yeah.
So really, like, one thing that I've gleaned from this conversation is that the structure of film school was helpful to you. It forced you to be more creative. It really made your brain sort of percolate and work harder in different ways. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I definitely think the structure is something that grounds you in that process and pushes you to, you know, evolve as a filmmaker. I do think another big motivator for going to film school, and what I would say to anybody who is considering it, is like, what it buys you is time,
mm-hmm.
what it buys you is space, and what it buys you is the community. And that community can be your cohort. That community can be your professors. It can be any of the visiting, you know, awesome rad human beings that mm-hmm. I mentioned. But it really just provides that kind of like sacred space.
Yeah, that was extremely well said. And once again, another great segue. Can you talk about your cohort of creators in New York? And it doesn't have to be just the people that you went to NYU with, yeah. people that you met outside of NYU, and kind of talk about how important having those connections was to you? Because I hear a lot about connections as being one of the most valuable things of film school. You know, you think about like the Robert Eggers of the world who met Jaron Blasky as DP in film school and has shot, you know, now every film with him. So can you kind of talk about the importance of having that community?
Yeah. One of the first things they tell us when we get into NYU is you're here because of who you are, but you're also here because of the people that are around you. They very much, like I always like to talk about casting my crew, like I cast my cast with any project. Like you have to find the people that can vibe, and they really make that intention when they craft a cohort. Mm-hmm. So when I started in my first year, we had a pretty big cohort. We had 36 different people from all over the world. I think 13 countries were represented.
Wow.
When COVID hit, that did go down a little bit. It was really sad to be in Zoom classes at normal times for, you know, Central Eastern time, and then have our Chinese classmates like across the world falling asleep in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
We did have quite a few people have to drop out.
Yeah.
Some joined with the cohort below. Some just weren't able to come back.
Mm-hmm.
But all to say, they create so much of the experience of film school because you're literally making all your films with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're crewing for them. They're crewing for you.
Yeah.
And it's like, luckily with our cohort, we all like, we're really copacetic. These are some of my best friends now. That's not always the case.
Yeah.
And we were just one of those classes that got really lucky. They mm-hmm. cast us really well. But I think in part, too, it was going through COVID together, like going through something that was so big, you know, for everybody. So it's like I so full-heartedly believe in every single person in my cohort, and I want to support their work until the day I am no longer here.
From an outside perspective, it's been really cool on the periphery to see some of these people that you've created these relationships with and just see not only your work blossom because of their help, but their work blossom because of your help. And that symbiotic relationship is something I'll always come back to, is one of the most beautiful things about what we do.
Totally.
So that's really great.
And what was so cool about the second year film, Making Layaway was the name of the film here in Iowa, was finally getting to bring some of those NYU friends and collaborators back to Iowa and like combining them with people like you and other filmmakers that I've worked with here in the state. Like seeing these two worlds collide was, it was really special. It was like exceptionally moving to witness.
Yeah. And it's still moving because, you know, I get to watch from, like I said, afar, someone like Andy make a film and have it just be a complete success and see her, you know, it is heartwarming to see, because going back to that sentiment that high tide raises all boats, like, we're all in this together, and like we're only as good as the people that we're around. And I'm really, really, getting towards the end of this conversation, I'm really happy to hear about this experience that you had at NYU. And from an educational standpoint, from a community standpoint, from a cohesion standpoint, it seems like the program was really valuable to you. And it's cool to be able to sort of decompress with you over this, you know, this podcast of all the years that you spent there. And it's just been, you know, it's hard not to get emotional on the podcast sometime, but it's been really cool to see you grow so much and been really cool to talk to you about it.
That means a lot.
Yeah. So
really appreciate that.
Yeah. What do you think? I'm just going to ask this straight up. What do you think had the biggest impact in you during your time in grad school? If you can pick one thing or one person or one project, what was it?
On a macro level, it's what I just said, which is like buying time for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that I did say the word buying, like it's an investment.
Yeah, you know? Costs money to go to grad school.
It does. Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah. That was the macro level. On the micro level, it was like the network that I'm coming out with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like the alumni network, I'm still being friends with current students. It's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. And that's, you know, how I hope that I'm going to continue to get my work and find the projects that I want to pour my energy into.
I think you brought up something that may be sort of the end tying up point of this, which is that from my perspective, this choice was an investment into yourself. And I think more filmmakers need to think about investing in themselves. You are good at this. You have what it takes to do it. You just have to believe in it. And I'm sure that the decision to go to NYU is not an easy one for you. I'm sure that you were scared.
Oh, some of the people that ran into me in those weeks leading up to the decision, they were like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. You know?
It's a big choice.
Yeah.
It's a big change.
It is.
Yeah. So I'll tee you off. Like, what ending point, like, what would be your sentiment to someone that is thinking about graduate film school?
You know, what it does many things, but it holds your feet. What's that phrase? What's that metaphor? Hold your feet to the fire, iron to the fire.
I mean, yeah, put your feet to the fire.
Put your feet to the fire.
It puts pressure on you.
It holds you accountable.
Yeah, it holds you accountable.
You can't get away with bullshit there. Like, can we cuss on this podcast?
Yes, we can.
You can't get away with bullshit. Like, if something's not honest, they're going to call you out on that shit.
They called you out before they even let you into the program.
Jesus.
They asked you what the time you felt the most shame and then told you to, like, take that and represent it visually. They called you out before you even got there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I will say, like, that can sound kind of abusive. That's not their intention at all. You hear about those acting programs that's like, oh, I'm going to tear the actor down before I build them back up. That's not this program. Like, thankfully, it's not. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they hold you accountable. Every professor in their own way holds you accountable, mm-hmm. you know. And you got to hold yourself accountable, too. I think that's the biggest thing I learned is, like, you know, you can get by making films that are pretty good. A lot of people see them maybe. But if you want to, like, notch yourself up to the next level, like, you got to hold yourself accountable and be really honest, kind of brutally honest with yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Bruce James Bales, and that is A Take.